This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From a field office in Canada, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Good to be with you.
We're going to start today in Taiwan. America's withdrawal from Afghanistan demonstrated its willingness to abandon its allies, even to leave its own people behind. Well, this deeply troubles many nations that rely on American security guarantees, and that includes the island nation of Taiwan, which has faced significant pressure from China, which considers Taiwan part of China. Well, tensions between these two are very high right now. To learn about this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, the defense minister of Taiwan actually said on Wednesday that tensions between China and Taiwan are currently at their worst state in 40 years. And if you look at everything that's happened there over the last week or so, you see that that's really no exaggeration at all. So this it started on Friday, October 1st, when China was celebrating the 72nd anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic. So that's a huge, just a very jingoistic celebration for the Chinese. And as part of those celebrations, China's People's Liberation Army flew 38 aircraft into Taiwan's air defense zone. Some of them were flown into the southwestern part of the air defense zone, and some went down into the Bashi Channel that separates Taiwan from the Philippines. But it was a total of 38 warplanes, and that broke a record for the most Chinese planes to violate Taiwan's airspace in a single day. And then on Saturday, China did it again, though on a somewhat smaller scale. On that day, they flew 18 fighter jets and two anti-submarine aircraft into Taiwan's air defense zone. Then on Sunday, it was back to some even larger numbers, this time with 36 planes. And then Monday, they shattered all records by a long shot by flying 56 planes off the southwest coast of Taiwan. So altogether, over that four-day period, you're looking at least 150 Chinese sorties that violated Taiwan's air defense zone. So this is just a stunning increase in this kind of provocative behavior from China. To give it a little bit of context, the year 2020 broke a big record on this front when China flew 380 sorties into Taiwan's air defense zone. So that was 380 for the whole year. And now they've conducted 150 in just 4 days. And if you look at 2021 as a whole, it's already up to 600 total Chinese incursions. And we still got a couple of months left on the calendar. So this is just a very alarming increase in this belligerent activity from China. And that's why I think it's really no exaggeration at all for Taiwan's defense ministers to say that tensions are now at their worst state in 40 years.
It raises red flags in particular, as I mentioned, in light of America's drawdown in Afghanistan, its abandonment of allies. And it has shown in some ways just less interest in fulfilling its role in guaranteeing the peace of foreign nations. Now, Asia is kind of an interesting case, and there's maybe some evidence that's a little bit anomalous or a little bit contrary to what you're seeing elsewhere. There was actually even revelations that America has a presence in China, military presence there. Maybe you could just talk about that a little bit before we continue the discussion.
Sure, yes. Yeah, it was on Thursday that the Wall Street Journal broke this story saying that a U.S. Special Operations Unit and a contingent of Marines have been secretly operating inside of Taiwan for at least a year now. So these are elite U.S. military forces. There are only about two dozen of them there, but they are elites, and they're there just in a training capacity. It's all part of efforts to basically shore up Taiwan's defenses to hopefully deter an invasion from China. Earlier this year, top U.S. military officials testified that China is likely to use force to annex Taiwan within 6 years. So that's the official estimate right now from the U.S. But the Taiwanese have an even shorter timeline right now. They believe China will be able to launch a full-scale attack on Taiwan with minimal losses by 2025. So just a couple of years away now. And that's why they are so determined to work closely with the U.S. right now to hopefully just build up their arms and their capabilities enough to convince China that an invasion wouldn't be worth the risk and wouldn't be worth the casualties that they would sustain. But China has just really lashed out about this new report. They view Taiwan, as you said in the introduction there, as a rebel province that is part of China, and they are just fiercely determined to bring it under control of the Chinese Communist Party. And they view the U.S.'s work with Taiwan as an extremely hostile intrusion into what they portray as an exclusively Chinese matter. And yesterday, the Global Times, which is really a mouthpiece for the Chinese Communist Party, they called these U.S. servicemen intruders. And they said, quote, "Just wait and see whether the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, will launch a targeted airstrike to eliminate those U.S. invaders." So, you know, some pretty inflammatory, rhetoric for sure, though it's not really anything that we haven't come to expect by now. But it really does all show that Taiwan is increasingly at the center of China's provocations and at the center of the efforts by the U.S. and its allies to counter Chinese aggression. And it's just an area, a flashpoint, really, where it's growing tenser by the day.
So let's put this in the context of biblical prophecy. This is an area that we have focused on over the years. Our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has written about Taiwan and America's determination to uphold its sovereignty. You look at the trend lines, and you see where America is heading, and you see where China is heading, and it seems as though a change in Taiwan status is virtually inevitable.
Yes, it really does look that way if you extrapolate out a little bit just from the current trends. And as you said, Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has been following and commenting on this whole Taiwan-China-U.S. dynamic for a number of years now. Back in 1998, he wrote about President Bill Clinton's decision to publicly speak out against Taiwanese independence. And Mr. Fleury said that that statement meant it was only a matter of time before China would conquer Taiwan. And he said it would happen because of what he called a, quote, pitifully weak-willed America. And in that article, Mr. Fleury explains that his understanding of that whole dynamic is based on Bible prophecy, and especially a passage in Leviticus that says America would become mired in sin and it would lose the will to use its power in a meaningful way. And then Mr. Fleury also spoke out about this dynamic again during an October 2020 episode of his Key of David television program. In this episode, he said, quote, "We have really forsaken little Taiwan, who used to be our foreign ally, but we just didn't have the courage to stand with them, so they're now really under the control of China," end quote. So I think that one's fascinating because he's saying there that it has already happened in some ways, even without a Chinese invasion. So very interesting, and it could mean that China will begin asserting its power over Taiwan much more forcefully, especially if, you know, as you mentioned with the Afghanistan situation, if China thinks that the U.S. is too tired of fighting overseas, too distracted by its own internal division to really do much about the Taiwanese situation, then I think we could expect a lot more force from the Chinese. Right now, the U.S. has those 24 Marines and special ops members there, but that's actually a nearly insignificant number, especially when you consider just how powerful the People's Liberation Army is. And many people right now are wondering why the U.S. doesn't do more for Taiwan, but Mr. Fleury's Bible-based analysis really answers that question. So I hope that anyone who hasn't read our free booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy, will order a copy of that. It has a section in there all about Taiwan, and it's all built on what Mr. Fleury has said on that topic.
Well, it is really difficult not to view these military jet incursions into Taiwanese airspace in light of America's position, declining position in the world. And it does, as you said, point back to that the will of the United States, that is really what is at issue here. And for China to be as belligerent as it is, I mean, in some ways, you look at the forecasts, you know, 3 years out, 6 years out to a full-scale invasion, and you wonder whether even something like that would be necessary for China to take full control over Taiwan the way that it is clearly intending to. How much U.S. resistance would it encounter if it were to do something like that? Well, do look at those resources, that Key of David from October 2020. We will post a link to that in the show notes for today's show, and also that Russia and China in Prophecy booklet that really does give the overview of the situation in Asia. Thank you for that, Jeremiah. After an election that saw Germany's ruling party suffer its worst result in generations, the nation is due for major political changes as leaders try to cobble together a ruling coalition. For the latest in Germany's political developments, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, it's been a busy week with German politicians meeting each other, and the shape of the most probable next coalition is starting to appear. It is not a done deal. It won't be a done deal for several weeks at the very earliest. They're talking about trying to get to the optimistic view is to try and get the coalition together before Christmas. And anyone could still walk away at all of those times and it could all collapse down. That's what happened last time. But the likely coalition is looking like the Social Democratic Party, the main kind of left-wing party, the Green Party, which tends to be the environmentalist and further left party, and then the Free Democratic Party, which is more of kind of like a pro-business party. I try to kind of, to put it in US terms, perhaps the best way you could say is it would be a coalition between Joe Biden, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and Ron Paul. So
I like that. Not
the most natural of allies, but that's the outcome of this election. There isn't a coalition where just natural allies or just people on the right or just people on the left get together and form a government. So this is looking like the one that the kind of is the most momentum behind it, and that they're moving forwards now with further negotiations.
So the CDU, the Christian Democrats and the Christian Socialists, they got a pretty good chunk of the vote, but not nearly enough to be relevant in these negotiations, apparently.
That's right. They were trying to have them kind of be the core party. They wanted a CDU Greens Free Democrat coalition instead. But this was their worst election result since World War II. It really was catastrophic for them. They did finish only maybe about 1.5% behind the Social Democrats. So on paper, the math worked out. There's still a viable potential coalition there. But the fact that they got such a beating and then the fact that they didn't win kind of puts the momentum much more solidly in the Social Democratic camp. And this is a big deal for Germany. In a lot of ways, for Germany, the Christian Democratic Union, Christian Social Union are kind of like the default parties of government. And you can look in all of Germany's history. I should have looked up the exact figure, but I think at least 2/3 of the time, if not more, it's the Christian Union parties that have been in government. And the kind of the times that they're out of government are the exception. So for them to be out of government, that's a big deal for Germany. It's a much more left-wing government probably than Germany is typically used to. And it's a big deal for those parties as well, for them to have lost this. And it's going to provoke some soul-searching, I think, within those parties. Some of that soul-searching will be limited by the fact that a lot of it is very clearly Armin Laschet's fault. The candidate that they chose, he did very badly. And you can look at the polls and things like that, and it's quite clearly his fault, or at least he, you know, it was his personal opinion polls that kind of pulled the party down. But at the same time, everybody that's tried to succeed Angela Merkel has personally done very badly. So it's clear that there are broader questions for the party as well. You know, how has it come to this place where anybody that they kind of put in as Merkel's replacement polled really badly? Why are they only having unpopular leaders rise to the top, or why do their leaders ending out this way?
So let's just talk about the prophecy. We talk often about the fact that the Bible prophesies that there will be a strong man presiding over Europe, and that there's every indication that he will come from Germany. And all of this turmoil and political mire that we see, the confusion politically within Germany, it really does create a power void in that country. We've talked a lot about how this could result in a dramatic change along the lines of what we saw in World War II, or prior to World War II, that brought Adolf Hitler to power. How might this unfold, in your view, as this coalition comes together and then tries to govern with such a motley arrangement of parties all trying to contribute to something in light of the prophecies that we understand?
So the prophecies talk about the strong leader coming in by flatteries, coming in by some kind of unorthodox means. And certainly if you have a coalition that's like a coalition between, you know, like I said, Joe Biden and Ron Paul, or something like that, you know, it's not going to be a stable coalition. You can easily see how some of these coalitions can become derailed. You can start to have what you have in Italy, where just a handful of voters can kind of derail the whole government, where you have coalitions falling apart and then different ones kind of coalescing without going to a vote. This kind of instability, that could certainly lead to the appetite for a strong leader to come in by some kind of unorthodox ways, or looking for a different way of doing things. I think another aspect of this that could be interesting to watch is that, you know, when Herbert W. Armstrong looked at this prophecy, he looked very closely at leaders from the Christian Union Party, specifically the Christian Social Union, the CSU, the Bavarian branch of the Christian Union parties. And he thought that Franz Josef Strauss, who was this strong man in the CSU, could well be that strong leader. And then we've kind of looked at first at his disciple, Edmund Stoiber, and then kind of one of the people that Stoiber really mentored, Karl Theodor zu Gutenberg, as the potential for to being that individual, all of which are from the Christian Social Union. So now as we have this big crisis in the Christian Social Union and this Christian Democratic Union and this big shakeup there, well, you can see the potential for that to somehow bring some of these individuals to the fore, to maybe cause some big changes within those parties that could see those kind of individuals coming to the surface. I think another interesting observation that Spiegel made about these elections is with people kind of switching all over the scene for which party they vote for, and people kind of picking and choosing between a wider range of parties, in a lot of ways party loyalty is becoming less significant within Germany. And they even asked the question, well, are we heading for an era of strongman politics, where personal magnetism, personal charisma is much more important than which party you vote for? And they pointed directly to Austria and Sebastian Kurz, who has really who rebuilt his party around himself and around almost a cult of personality and something that's very focused on the individual, which will be interesting to see if Germany's politics does follow that direction as well. But you can certainly see it being pushed in that direction of strongman politics too.
Well, that is a fascinating trend, and we've been following that in several European nations for quite a few years now. You see that strongman rising up in several nations, and the fact that that's happening basically everywhere except for the strongest nation in Europe is quite fascinating. There's still this void there at the head of Europe's strongest country, and Germans feel it. There's a lot of frustration. You see that in election results such as those that we just had in that nation. But it's also a European-wide problem, isn't it? Because that leadership isn't being helmed properly from the most important nation in the entire Union.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, we've been talking a lot about this push for a European military and how Europe wants a European military. They just had a big meeting this week on having a European military that they organized in the wake of Afghanistan, in the wake of this new alliance, the AUKUS alliance, that kind of got France especially all shook up. And it was inconclusive. It was divided. And so far, there's not been much that has come out of that meeting. And so, yeah, you can see a big part of the reason why is the lack of that leadership, is the lack of somebody to say, to step out there with some big ideas and some big visions and to say, okay, well, this is what we're doing. And if you like it, get behind it. And if you don't like it, we're moving forwards without you. There just isn't really somebody with that gravitas. I think Emmanuel Macron would kind of like to be that individual.
Right.
But he's been in power for quite a long time now, and he's quite comprehensively failed. He doesn't have France behind him enough, and really, all of those questions kind of get back to Germany. Germany would be the wrong one bankrolling a European military. Germany's government is structured, or their coalition, their constitution in such a way they'd have to sign off on such a military force and its deployments. So until you get that kind of strong leader, it's not just Germany that is waiting for it, but all of Europe.
Yeah. Yeah, just the fact that it has to be a strong German leader is becoming more obvious all the time as you see this kind of morass that Europe finds itself in. We do have a booklet called A Strong German Leader is Imminent, written by our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, describing the prophecies that inform this view. Anything else that you would point people to for more information on what to expect in Germany in the time ahead?
Well, I just mentioned that early next week, I think we should have an article from Joshua Michels on the Trumpet website that should discuss this subject and give you an update on where the German elections are going.
All right, very good. We'll look forward to that. Thank you very much, Richard. Disturbing information emerged this week about the perpetrator of a terrorist attack on U.S. forces in the final days of America's evacuation from Afghanistan. For this story, we'll turn to Brent Nachtigall.
Yeah, it's been 39 days since the United States evacuated from Afghanistan, and you see the stories about it, what's happening in Afghanistan, really just disappear from the mainstream media. Yet there was one this week that should stand out to a lot of people because it gets to the cause of why 13 Americans were killed in that terrorist attack that took place a few days before the United States exited just outside the international airport there in Kabul. And this relates to who that suicide bomber was. He has been named, and I won't really tell you the name, but nevertheless, he was an ISIS-K terrorist. And this is an organization, of course, the United States said was behind the attack. However, where he came from is what the compelling news is in this story. And this came out that this was a fighter that was in prison just a few days earlier. He was in the Parwan prison, which was located at the Bagram Air Base. Of course, we've talked about what happened with the United States deciding to evacuate the air base first and then keep its citizens in the country and then finally try to leave from the airport, and how that those so many weapons that were given over to the Taliban because of that. But we haven't really focused as much on who these 5,000 terrorists were that were housed at the Bagram Air Base, or at least a prison there, and what they have done or what they're going to do in the future. And so it turns out, based on two U.S. officials, as well as Republican Ken Calvert, a Californian Republican, he blew the cover on this week, that one of these men that were released by the Taliban when they took over this prison was an ISIS-K fighter, and he came and he was the one perpetrator behind the massive suicide attack that killed 184 people and 13 Americans. So again, this is just another indication of how disastrous the United States withdrawal from Afghanistan was, that if it was carefully planned in a different matter, if they decided to pull the people out first, maybe then leave Bagram Air Base last if they want, and leave the 5,000 sure terrorists in that prison, there wouldn't be 13 American servicemen killed today, and perhaps some greater danger to the U.S. homeland as well.
As if there wasn't enough evidence already, this was written about by our editor-in-chief in the latest print edition of The Trumpet, his cover story in our All Afghanistan issue. Was titled Chaos by Design, or that was the title on the cover. His article was called This Isn't Incompetence, This Is Treason. And the evidence that this was deliberately intended to put the blackest mark on America really is overwhelming.
Right, and this is what we reported on at the start, how that, you know, this, when this terrorist attack took place, that, yeah, the Taliban was saying it was ISIS-K, the United States, the Biden administration's ISIS-K, not the Taliban. But Mr. Flurry wrote in that article, I'll quote him now, just days before the evacuation was to be completed, a terrorist attack at the Kabul airport killed 182 people, including 13 American servicemen. The Taliban have armed checkpoints on every road leading to that airport. Clearly, they allowed suicide bombers and armed gunmen to commit that heinous act. But then he says, Mr. Flurry writes, but Biden's people said they needed to work with the Taliban to prevent more attacks. And that's what we see here. The Taliban took over this prison. And the Taliban then killed the ISIS-K leader at that point, changed kind of the leadership structure. This is according to Michael Preachant, a intelligence officer that worked in Afghanistan and Iraq, changed kind of the command structure of ISIS-K and basically set them, ISIS-K, some new orders. And what do we have a few weeks later? Or just 11 days later, we have this attack that was an ISIS-K member but went through security checkpoints. Now, the bigger question is that this is 13 Americans that have died, but this doesn't end right now. We also know that there's over 20,000 at-risk Afghanis right now, at risk by the State Department, they say, that are inside the United States. And so we might not see the end of this disastrous decision to allow thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of Afghanis into the United States soon after we have the 5,000 terrorists released from this prison. Are some of those terrorists in the United States right now? We know that these people weren't vetted. U.S. congressmen have come out this week saying that it's impossible to vet the Afghanis that are currently in the United States because they didn't leave, that they didn't bring documentation with them, and perhaps they were unknown. And so this is something that could spell disaster, not just for what's happened in the past, but for the U.S. homeland going forward. Again, this article that Mr. Flurry wrote is a must-read. Again, it's entitled This Isn't Incompetence, This Is Treason. It goes into these stunning decisions that are worse than poor, but actually plan to hurt the American homeland, or America, and perhaps even the American homeland. And going forward, this is something we might see.
All right. We do appreciate that. Brent, anyone who thought that Joe Biden would rule as U.S. president as a moderate has to be stunned by just how radical his administration has proved to be. Further evidence of how far left this government is emerged recently with Biden's choice for a top economics post. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, the Biden administration is getting more and more radical by the day. This month, the Senate confirmed an eco-terrorist implicated in a tree-spiking plot to head up the Bureau of Land Management. And then Joe Biden followed up by nominating a woman who believes the Soviet economy is superior to America's economy to be the comptroller of the currency. Sole Omavera is graduated from Moscow State University in 1989 on the Lenin Personal Academic Scholarship and has some extremely radical opinions. The Wall Street Journal did an expose on her, really focusing on the fact that she's, her goal is to have the Federal Reserve take over for the private banks, basically function as not just a central bank, but the only bank in America. Big fan of digital currency, a digital currency run by the Federal Reserve that would give the central bank of the United States great power over the economy, and then even going beyond regulating the currency to actually set wages. This is a quote from her from 2019, where she says, "Until I came to the U.S., I couldn't imagine that things like the gender pay gap still exist in the world today. Say what you will about the old Soviet Union, there was no gender pay gap there. The market doesn't always know best. I never claimed women or men were treated absolutely equal in every facet in Soviet life, but people's salaries were set by the state in a gender-blind manner, and all women got very serious maternity benefits. Both things are still a pipe dream in our society today." So basically lecturing the United States on how much better things were back in the USSR, mm-hmm. and saying this, like, hey, if we're going to get rid of the gender pay gap, that you can't have private employers deciding what they're going to pay their employees. Right. You need the government to come in and tell them what they're going to pay their employees and set, actually do like price setting here in the United States. She'd also authored two papers advocating for expanding the Federal Reserve's mandate to include the price levels of systematically important financial assets as well as worker wages. So that's actually going on, having the Federal Reserve tell people what they're going to make a year, but actually even setting the prices. And then she went on in another paper called the People's Ledger, which I don't know about, but sounds pretty Soviet, that she proposed that the Federal Reserve basically take over consumer bank deposits. So the comptroller of the economy, the position that Biden gave her, is designed to regulate banks in the United States. And like I said, ironically, like the person now regulating the banks, like really, 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 really hates private banks, mm-hmm. And has gone on record saying that basically her goal is to abolish the private banks in America, so the Federal Reserve, run by the federal government, can just set people's wages, set the prices of things, and do all the good stuff that resulted in bread lines back in her hometown. Mm.
Pretty stunning. Where would you send people who want more information about the Biden administration and the decisions that it's making, such as the one you just described?
Right. Well, I mean, the article Brent mentioned earlier about this isn't incompetence, this is treason, is a great article to look at too, just showing that, like, you're deliberately appointing people from Soviet universities who want to abolish our banks and set our wages. It's like, this isn't just like a matter of not vetting someone very well. This is a deliberate choice to put an overt communist over the United States economy. But also, there's a chapter in the Great Again booklet by our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, entitled The Roots of America's Dangerous Turn Left. That really goes through a lot of the history of basically the communist plot to take over the United States, going all the way back to Alger Hiss and the New Left and the 1970s, and just showing how that this has come right up through the Obama administration and now Obama's Vice President Joe Biden as a means to deliberately destroy capitalism and the U.S. Constitution from the inside out.
All right. Very good. Thank you for that, Andrew. We will link to that chapter in the show notes from that booklet, Great Again. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to look at two very different approaches to dealing with illegal immigrants, one in America, the other in Europe. And shocking new footage shows border agents beating and abusing migrants to drive them back home. Which of these two powers do you think is guilty? We'll be right back. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Japan continues its path toward militarization. To learn about its latest move, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, it was on Sunday that an F-35 warplane took off from a Japanese destroyer called the Izumo, and then a short time later, the jet returned to the ship and landed on it. So, you know, this may sound like a fairly typical military exercise, but in fact, this was a major milestone for Japan because it marks the first time since World War II that a Japanese vessel has launched and recovered a fixed-wing aircraft. The vessel that this happened on was the Izumo, as I mentioned. There. And when the Izumo was launched in 2013, the Japanese classified it as a helicopter destroyer. This is largely because the constitution that was imposed on Japan after World War II strictly forbids the country from having offensive sea, air, and land weapons. And aircraft carriers are well understood to be some of the most capable offensive weapons platforms out there. So Japan hoped that by branding the Izumo and its sister ship, the Kaga, as helicopter carriers instead, then they might not be seen as violating that pacifist clause in their constitution as flagrantly. So, you know, it was always suspicious, and it was always a fairly obvious example of stretching the rules to an absurd degree. But then last year, the Japanese started dropping even what little pretense there had been. That's when they started making modifications to the Izumo and the Kaga that let the vessels accommodate fixed-wing aircraft. And now this week, we've seen really the culmination of all of that with the launch and recovery of the F-35B. It's also worth noting that the F-35s are just stunningly powerful fighter jets, and the B variant that was used in this drill is capable of very short takeoff and vertical landing. So that makes them perfect for the smaller decks of the Izumo and the Kaga. And Japan actually has 42 of these on order from the United States right now. And then the Japanese also have another batch of 105 of the standard F-35, the A version, on order. So just a bewildering number of these state-of-the-art jets, and they are putting them to use on aircraft carriers. So this is just a huge step, a very significant step in Japan's military buildup.
Put it in context of what's been happening in Japan for quite some time. You said it was the first time since World War II. That's really what we look back to when we look at why this is concerning.
Yes. Yeah, we actually just crossed the 71st anniversary of the creation of Japan's so-called self-defense force. And it's very sobering, I think, to see just how far this military machine has come since its very humble beginnings. So it was in the immediate aftermath of World War II that Japan started to maintain no military of any kind. The U.S. and other allied powers stripped them of all of that, and they occupied Japan. They enshrined those pacifist constraints that we talked about into their constitution. But then, when the Korean War broke out in 1950, the U.S. needed to relocate the troops that it had in Japan to Korea. So that's when the U.S. asked the Japanese government to organize what they called a national police force. This was a very small force, just 74,000 men, that were mainly intended to take the place of the U.S. troops that needed to be moved to Korea. So Japan formed this small police force, and then in 1954, it was expanded and renamed the Ground Self-Defense Force. And from there, the size and the capability of the force both just kept on growing. And before long, the Japanese soldiers were even engaging in joint military drills with U.S. forces. In the 1990s, this Japanese force underwent even faster growth. And that's when it became a very well-armed and formidable military, able to conduct all manner of operations. And then finally, in the 2000s, it became what we know it as today. This ultra-modern, fully integrated assemblage of land, sea, and air components. It's got 250,000 troops now, and it's believed to be able to rival the military of almost any other world power. Most rankings right now put it at number 4 in the world, just after the U.S., Russia, and China, and just above India. So the Japanese military has come a long way, and now, to all the other capabilities that it's acquired, we can now add that it can launch and recover fixed-wing aircraft from its aircraft carriers, and that's an extremely notable milestone.
Well, we do have an article on thetrumpet.com on this subject. Japanese carrier launches first plane since World War II. We also have a trend article, Why the Trumpet Watches Japan's March Toward Militarism. We'll link to both of those in the show notes for the program today. Thank you very much, Jeremiah. Now to this story about Border Patrol and dealing with illegal immigrants. The mainstream media would have you believe that America is terribly harsh and repressive in trying to keep migrants out, while Europe is compassionate and enlightened toward refugees. We'll show evidence that undermines both of these views. First, we'll learn the truth about the situation in America from Andrew Miller.
Yeah, a 2020 survey found that the Border Patrol agency ranked very close to the bottom on a list of best places to work in the federal government. The Border Patrol agents, there's not a ton of employee satisfaction right now. And just looking at the type of problems that these agents are up against, and you can see why. This fiscal year, we know of 1.5 million immigrants who have crossed the border this fiscal year already, and they haven't actually even reported the numbers for September yet, which is the last month of the fiscal year. So it's probably 1.7 million people have crossed the border. And so just for context, there's about 1.5 million people who live in the city of Philadelphia, which is one of our top 10 biggest cities. So you're looking at like an entire metropolitan region of people just crossing the Rio Grande into the United States within 12 months. I mean, you're setting historical records. I think right now you're looking at more immigrants that have ever come into America this fast since the year 2000. And within a few months, it'll probably even blow past those records. And so some pretty tough problems that these border agents are up against. And now, on top of that, you've got the fact that they're getting very little support from their boss and the higher ups in America. I mean, I'm sure a lot of our listeners have heard the story that a lot of these agents, they're on horseback because they're out in like desert regions policing the Rio Grande. You've got hundreds and thousands of people coming across that you're trying to catch. They've got something called I don't ride horses much, but something called a split rein that really helps like maneuver horses in some of these arid regions. Well, they caught on video footage one of these agents where his split rein, where his horse turned quick and hit one of the immigrants coming in, and so that went viral, and you've heard all sorts of comments from the people who are these border agents report to. I mean, Joe Biden said it was a horrible situation and that the agents responsible would pay for it. Vice President Kamala Harris alleged that the Border Patrol's horseback tactics were actually similar to tactics used against African Americans during the time of slavery. Mm-hmm. Maxine Waters said it was actually worse than the days of slavery. And then Alana Presley said that it was white supremacist behavior. So really just some ignorant and foolish comments. I mean, it's not like these people are driving them with slave whips. I mean, you got an immigrant got grazed with a split rein. And now, like I said, Biden's saying that the agents who did this are going to pay for it, and he's going to make them pay. So you can just imagine if you're a Border Patrol agent right now, you're going to be extra careful that your horse rein doesn't graze anybody. And so it might just be easier. I don't know. If I was a Border Patrol agent, it might just be easier to sit there on horseback and count them as they come across, because that seems to be what the Biden administration is hoping for.
This is the story. This is the version of events that we're hearing so often, is that the border agents are repressive and so on. When you look at it from through the lens of Bible prophecy, you really get a different view.
Right. The border agents are not being repressive. I mean, far from it. They're basically open the borders, and they're letting millions of people pour in. I think of that 1.5 million that they've apprehended, at least 500,000 have already just been turned loose into the United States with instructions to appear in court at a certain date, which none of them will probably do. But it really does get back to a prophecy we've discussed many times on this program that's discussed in length in an article by our editor-in-chief we'll put in the show notes, Where America's Race Riots Are Leading. And that article, it talks about the blessing and cursings chapter in Deuteronomy 28, particularly verse 52, about America being besieged in all their gates till their high and fenced walls come down. And that scripture is really kind of like a 1-2 punch. The besiegement's more about like foreign nations besieging our economy. But those high and fenced walls come down are about migrants pouring in uninhibited. It's really what you see where you've got now, yeah, people pouring in by the thousand. There's not really any good walls stopping them at the places they're coming through. There's not really good security. You've got some agents on horseback, but even they're really reluctant to do their jobs because if anyone gets grazed with a rain, they could be fired or prosecuted or something like that. And so now you've got all these agents, immigrants, many of whom work for drug cartels, some of whom who have COVID, bringing disease and crime and all these other curses into the United States, just like the cursings chapter in the Bible predicted.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we do appreciate you bringing that story to us. We will link to an article called Where America's Race Riots Are Leading that just talks about the social breakdown caused by problems such as the immigration crisis. Thank you, Andrew. Now, a contrasting picture within Europe, which, despite its reputation for enlightened treatment of outsiders, is handling migrants very differently. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, Der Spiegel magazine had an expose this week titled Europe's Violent Shadow Army Unmasked. It was an investigation into European border guards, and what they found was much more disturbing than even the face value allegations from the United States. So they found people in with a dark uniform and with kind of special types of truncheons deliberately beating migrants until they turned around and crossed borders. They talk about one video, for example, that shows men chasing 22 refugees out of the European Union territory in Croatia and forcing them back into Bosnia-Herzegovina. And it shows it shows masked men swinging clubs at the legs of migrants and basically beating them back into a river. The article also talks about Coast Guard forces packing migrants into boats and towing them out to sea, so that they'll drift across into Turkish waters. So not even moving people who are already in boats, but taking people who are on land, putting them into pitting them into boats with no engines and then shoving them off. They included a quote from they talked to a Bosnian border guard who said that he'd seen countless occasions of encountering injured and bleeding people who had been beaten on the Croatian side of the border. He said there have been cases where they've been beaten up groups so badly that each of them ends up in hospital. And he says, well, he basically says it's essentially torture. And the Spiegel kind of dug into who these groups are, and it certainly does appear to be government sanctioned, and it talked about how it comes from the top. And having basically these special police units come around and beat up migrants so that they don't come into the country.
So this is consistent with other things that we've seen from Europe and the way that it handles migrants. You alluded to a couple of them, but this has been obviously a huge issue that Europe has faced for some time. And some of what they have done has been troubling. It's not necessarily as dramatic as what we see here, but maybe you can just put it in the context of other measures that Europe has taken that really do demonstrate its will to deal with this problem.
So right now, Lithuania and Poland are building big border fences. Again, it's always Donald Trump's wall that gained the media attention, and everybody in Europe, Angela Merkel, the Pope, they all condemned Donald Trump for building a border wall. They're all silent now that Poland and Lithuania are building a border wall because of migrants coming across their borders. You're right. This is a big deal. And I think the main way that Europe has dealt with this is by engaging with leaders directly within the Middle East and North Africa. So they'll pay and equip Turkish border forces. And there were reports before of Turkey even shooting migrants that come across the borders. And, well, they're shooting them with guns provided to them for that purpose by the European Union. You had the situation until he was booted out of Omar al-Bashir in Sudan, a known wanted war criminal, being paid money by the European Union to lock migrants in concentration camps. And that's another way that they'll deal with things. And again, there was just a story just this week where Egypt has been rewarded for its treatment of migrants by a $3 billion railway deal with Siemens. So normally it's for Europe to work directly with these African countries. And I think that is really the prophetic angle of this story, beyond just pointing out the hypocrisy that we see in the world, is that there's a lot of key Bible prophecies about Europe becoming more involved in the Middle East, more involved in North Africa. And you can see how these migrant crises that it's facing, and you can see why Europe's worried about these migrants. You can see that drawing them into these countries, making alliances with different players in these countries, getting involved in their own right in these countries as they try to get this problem under control.
What would be a good resource for people who want more information?
So I did write about this story a few years ago, Who Really Locks Migrants in Concentration Camps, and that goes through pretty much everything we've talked about here, these different measures that Europe takes. Obviously, it doesn't have this latest news that we didn't know about migrant European forces beating migrants directly themselves back then. But certainly how this trend is pulling Europe into the Middle East and North Africa, and exactly how this is a key moment in Bible prophecy.
Thank you very much, Richard. We'll link to that in the show notes. One final story. Inflation in America is real. We can all feel it. And where you probably feel it most is at the grocery store. Why are food prices rising so fast? For answers, we'll go back to Andrew.
Yeah, an increasing number of Americans can no longer afford their groceries as inflation, extreme weather, and supply chain problems drive up the price of food. The Personal Consumption Expenditure Price Gauge is the Federal Reserve's preferred way to track inflation, and that's actually up 4.3% from a year ago, meaning that the dollars in your pocket only buy 96% of what they could have bought if you'd have spent them 12 months ago. That's the highest inflation rate since 1991, but the situation's even worse when it comes to food. The food price, it's going up with everything else because of inflation, but also because of drought in the western United States and the fact that there's such a global shortage of semi-truck drivers, airplane pilots, ships, crews, due to the COVID lockdowns, mean that a lot of food is having trouble getting to its destination. And the end result of all that is the price of beef, poultry, fish, and eggs is up almost 6% over last year's prices and up nearly 16% from pre-pandemic prices. Food banks across America are on pace to distribute 6.5 billion meals to 42 million people this year. That's 20% more than the 35 million people who turned to food banks before the pandemic began. So millions and millions of people who can no longer afford food because of these COVID lockdowns and the worker shortages, and really this what amounts to a deliberate attack on the U.S. economy. There's no logical reason to lock down the economy to save a few thousand lives from COVID when that decision drives 20 million people to food banks in order to not die from starvation. This is something we've covered quite a bit about, just this deliberate attack on the American economy. And I guess for the third time this program, we can recommend that this isn't incompetence, this is treason article. But we'll also put a booklet that we offer in the show notes, How to Solve Your Money Problems, that it doesn't offer too much commentary on the current events and the COVID lockdowns and the rising price of food, but it does just also give just some very sound biblically based advice on how to solve your money problems that everyone's probably going to need more than they have in the past in the months forward, as the price of commodities that have historically been cheap get more and more expensive due to this just really sinister attack on the U.S. economy.
Well, we appreciate you bringing that to us. I'm sure we're going to be hearing more about that. Andrew is beginning to work on an article for the upcoming print edition about just the dangers in disruptions to supply chains that affect our economies all across the board, just many, many ways that these the ripple effects from COVID lockdowns and other problems that are occurring right now demonstrate the curses that the Bible has prophesied we will suffer in this end time. And we can all feel it. We can all feel it to one degree or another, and it's intensifying as time goes on. We thank you very much for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Parker Campbell for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Merlin Mann. Priorities are like arms. If you have more than two, you are crazy or you're lying. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.